Thank you, Dick. Brie is very special to me because of what I learned from working with Schaefer, because I met my English wife there, and my son and daughter were born there, and I've met many people over the years, like Dick there. And what I learned at Libri has stayed with me and been the basis for much of what I've been doing. Tonight, I'm adapting an article that was just published this spring. I got to know a Romanian Orthodox Christian postgrad student in Oxford who was part of a group of Romanian Orthodox scholars in Oxford and Cambridge, and they were publishing a little review that they called the Oxbridge Philokalic Review. Oxbridge is the English way of mushing Oxford and Cambridge together, just to talk about academia in general. Philokalic is Greek for love of the good, love of excellence. And last fall, he said, Joe, our spring issue is going to be on the New Jerusalem, and would you write a meditation on the New Jerusalem for publication? So the notes have the original title that's in here, Oxbridge and the New Jerusalem. But I told Libri to change the title to work, because I've not lost the emphasis on academia, but I've broadened it the way it quite properly should be broadened, to cover all work of Christians. I just had a cataract removed from my right eye and a corrective lens put in, so I see very well with my right eye, and my left eye won't be done until the middle of June. So I hope I can read okay. Tertullian's question, what does Jerusalem have to do with Athens, the church with the academy, is a well-known quote and often used to highlight anti-intellectualism among some Christians. Many in today's academia and the wider culture betray a similar attitude toward the church. That is, toward any assertion of a transcendent reality outside the competence of natural science. So by reversing and updating Tertullian, it could be expressed this way. What does Oxbridge have to do with the New Jerusalem? The academy and the modern world with ancient religious visions of the future. And my answer is more than you might at first think. On the other hand, the negative answer of many may be expressed by a rhetorical rephrasing of the question, what possible relevance can pre-scientific imaginings have for people involved in the study of this world? The art and the literature these imaginings produce may well command appreciative aesthetic analysis, and religious beliefs themselves, along with other superstitions, may properly be studied by historians and cultural anthropologists, but such visions can have no meaning in a scientific search for truth. You and I have to live in the real world of technology and the internet, not of strange visions. Indeed, if there is no transcendent creator who cares about the world, no infinite personal God who is there sustaining and giving meaning to our study and our work in this created order, then the implied answer is sound: none. But if there really is only chance plus time plus matter in motion, that is, matter in motion until its eventual entropic heat death, then the real question is not simply the relevance of ancient visions, but more profoundly, the final value and meaning of all academic study, indeed of all work, of all life in this world. Without a truly transcendent future, I would say without the New Jerusalem, any success in increasing scientific understanding of creating works of art, music, literature, of simply making this world better or work is fleeting and tiny in cosmic terms. Woody Allen has said that in order to distract us from the awful truth about the meaninglessness of everything, we need diversions. Now, Woody Allen was thinking of entertainment. But if nothing we do lasts, then on what basis can Oxbridge claim, can any of us claim, that our work is more than our diversion of choice? There are those whose worldview allows no place for any non-material reality, for anything which could transcend their philosophical naturalism. The assertion of Stephen Newton of the National Center for Science Education here in this country is unambiguous. It needs to be said clearly. All educated people understand there are no forces outside of nature. Some of these thinkers, with open honesty, go on to state the future they see implied by their understanding of a purely natural world, of close to transcendence. Perhaps the best known expression of this view of humanity's future is that of Bertrand Russell. Russell said that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. J.W.N. Sullivan puts it this way: the vast extent of the universe, both in space and time, is, from the human point of view, completely aimless. Those immense lumps of matter in their millions of millions, incessantly pouring out an inconceivably furious energy for millions of millions of years, seem to be completely pointless. For a fleeting moment, man has been permitted to stare at this gigantic and meaningless display. Long before the process comes to an end, man will have vanished from the scene, and the rest of the performance will take place in the unthinkable night of the absence of all consciousness. Or Arthur Balfour: the energies of our solar system will decay, the glory of the sun will be dimmed, and the earth will no longer tolerate the race which has for a moment disturbed its solitude. Man will go down into the pit, and all his thoughts will perish. The uneasy consciousness which in this obscure corner has for a brief space broken the contented silence of the universe will be forever at rest. Matter will know itself no longer. Imperishable monuments and immortal deeds, death itself and love stronger than death, will be as if they had not been. Nor will anything that is be better or worse for all that the labor, genius, devotion, and suffering of man have striven through countless ages to effect. After describing the lateness and brevity of life on earth, Leslie Paul concludes this way: the lonely planet will cool. All life will die. All mind will cease. And it will be as if it had never happened. That, to be honest, is the goal to which evolution is traveling. That is the benevolent end of the furious living and furious dying. All life is no more than a match struck in the dark and blown out again. The final result is to deprive it completely of meaning. But those in Oxbridge and elsewhere who do not limit their worldview in this way, but who believe in an infinite personal God who creates, who cares, who acts, and who can speak, do not need to be shut up to such pessimism. For such, the New Jerusalem is not at all an ancient irrelevance. It is an encouragement. An encouragement to anyone willing to listen that there is a different narrative, a narrative within which our study and all of our work does have final meaning. Our lives of research are not just a fleeting moment to stare at this meaningless display, or a match struck in the dark and blown out again. A life lived for the glory of God, in fact, all of the work we do has significance beyond our own brief space in this world. Our work before the infinite personal God and for His glory is not merely a brief space for an uneasy consciousness to break the contented silence of the universe, until finally, forever at rest, matter will know itself no longer. The church teaches from the Bible a different narrative. This different narrative frames our present existence inside a meaningful past and a divine future. No study limited to this world could predict that future. But the God who speaks has revealed it. The beautiful thing about the vision of the New Jerusalem granted in the Revelation to St. John is not only that it promises fulfillment of God's purposes in the future, but also it gives meaning to all that we may do now. The pursuit of knowledge of this world that Oxbridge engages in has significance and value now and forever. It has significance and value by being related to the infinite reference point of the Creator God, and because it is done in accordance with God's creative purpose for man to rule and care for the world. The effort to bring about human flourishing through education, through medicine, through individual integrity in business, individual acts of care or charity, all of these and all of the arts are important in God's eyes and will be caught up in the consummation of divine purpose for which the New Jerusalem can serve us as a shorthand. There's a tendency to trust in no future except that of our own construction. With no eternal in view, and no one who can speak from outside of our limited existence, chance and change always trump ideas of order and purpose. Let us as Christians be willing, without that constraint, to look at this ancient religious vision in order to gain the perspective which it has to offer, not only to Oxbridge, but to all of us. The account of the New Jerusalem is found in Revelation chapter 21, verse 1 through chapter 22, verse 5. And it begins, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among people, and He will dwell with them. They will be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.' He who was seated on the throne said, 'I am making everything new.' Then he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' He said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children.'" It continues, "One of the seven angels came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb.' And he carried me away in the Spirit to a mountain great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." There are some aspects of the description which were especially meaningful to readers in the first century who were undergoing persecution, and also to persecuted believers in many parts of the world today. Other aspects will be meaningful to believers in any age and any circumstances. And there may well be some aspects to which believers in the 21st century, Oxbridge and everywhere, can especially relate. All believers can thrill to the description of the New Jerusalem, the Holy City, under the following headings. And you have my five headings there. 1, God's dwelling place. 2, immense in size. 3, strong and secure. 4, pure from evil or falsehood. And 5, showing continuity, even as part of a new heaven and a new earth. Now, I could read the rest of the chapter, but I'll be quoting things from it. Can you trust me to be quoting correctly? Or would you like me to read the rest of the chapter? All right. 1, God's dwelling place. The holy city, the New Jerusalem, is not the residence of the redeemed and renewed humanity. It is not where they live. The New Jerusalem, the holy city, is redeemed humanity, the bride of Christ, the people of God. This is not only said explicitly in verses 1 to 3, it is also implied by the description of the city as a perfect cube. The innermost part of the old temple in Jerusalem, the most holy place where God's presence dwelled with His people Israel, was cube-shaped. The living space of redeemed humanity is the entire new earth. But they, redeemed humanity, are the place where God dwells. No longer is the innermost part of a physical building the temple in Old Jerusalem, but rather within the whole church, the whole body of Christ, within the New Jerusalem, on the new earth. They will live in perfect fellowship with the incarnate Redeemer God, like a bride is with a husband. This perfect fellowship means that the limited self-transcendence, which is seen in both science and the arts, finds its ground and coherence in personal communion with the ultimate transcendence of God. And that limited transcendence is perfected in fellowship with God. As James Loder says of the human spirit, the human spirit is not an accident doomed to wander aimlessly in the universe, endlessly crying out, "Why?" in the still darkness of empty space. Our spirit's inner logic, its creative drive to construct coherence and remain open to ultimacy, its irrepressible self-transcendence and transformational potential, its revulsion at confusion and its discovery of order in chaos, point beyond itself. Loder continues, "So what is called for is one who is infinitely conscious, intelligent, and infinitely creative, whose very presence brings order out of chaos and continually restores the spirit to itself as spirit. The presence of the infinite personal God is what the new humanity in the New Jerusalem will have, fulfilling not only our spiritual longings, but also providing that ultimate ground for all of science and art which Oxbridge by itself cannot give." Immense in size. The dimensions of the city, 12,000 stadia in length, 12,000 stadia in width, and 12,000 stadia in height, a perfect cube, is pointless to translate into kilometers or miles, or any other measure. The measurement is not physical or literal. It is meant to express completeness and immense fullness by combining two figures, each of which have symbolic meaning. 12 often stands for a complete whole, as seen in 12 tribes of Israel, 12 apostles, or 12 months of the year. 1,000 typically means very large. Combined in the city's measurements, we find this. By adding the 12 edges of the cube, since each edge is 12,000 stadia, we get a figure of 144,000. 12 times 12,000. This number appears earlier in Revelation to refer to the redeemed, and also to the words, "a great multitude." So, immense in size. And when we are discouraged now by seeming to be a tiny minority in Oxbridge or in the world, we should take heart. The full scope of God's final redemption is beyond our present numbering or imagination. Third, strong and secure. The immense security of the New Jerusalem is signified by a great high wall around the city. The wall not only is 144 cubits thick, note the multiplication of 12 by 12, so a 12, perfection multiplied by perfection as a high protective wall. If you wanted to translate that into ordinary measurements, which wasn't intended, it's about 70 meters thick. So, it also, this wall, has 12 foundations. Even further, there's an angel standing guard at each of 12 gates. It is hard to imagine a fuller image of security than a wall 70 meters thick with an angel guarding each gate. But then John goes on to say that the gates will never need to be shut. What more dramatic a statement of security could there be than that? In this present world, science and technology are co-opted for conflict, for aggression, as well as for protection, while the arts are co-opted for propaganda. Furthermore, war itself raises questions of the relevance of academic study, which C.S. Lewis found it necessary to address in his important sermon, Learning in Wartime. If you haven't read it, do. In the University Church in Oxford in World War II, he gave that. Should not the promise of security inspire and challenge us even now to use our study and research and work for peace, for conflict resolution, and for healing? 4. Pure from evil or falsehood. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful. This city, and remember, the city is the redeemed people living in the new earth. The new earth is where they live. This city, the redeemed, will be a wholesomely purified people. This means in human terms that there will be none of the jealousies, pride, self-advancement, competition, dishonesty, misuse of position to dominate, or any other of the temptations to which business, the academy, and indeed every human organization, including churches, now are subject. What a model for believers to seek to follow even now in Oxbridge, in business, in government, in the church. Today we struggle with idolatries and false ideologies. They deceive and confuse us in our attempt to understand the immense cosmos and this amazing world we inhabit within it. They tempt us to lower our standards of honesty and fairness of discussion in public engagement and private argument both. Cannot we take inspiration from a future world of truth to seek to be wholly truthful in presenting our work and fair in discussion or in critique of the work of others? Showing continuity even as part of a new heaven and a new earth. The setting in which the New Jerusalem is introduced is that of a new heaven and a new earth. This renewed creation, the whole new earth, rather than the city itself, is the living and working space of redeemed people. We have seen that the city represents them rather than being just a location where they live on the new earth. The whole new earth is these things which it says the redeemed people will inherit. We're told that certain things will be given to these peoples on the new earth. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Verses 24 and 26. The splendor of the kings of the earth and the glory and honor of the nations must be about far more than any material wealth, which may rightly have encouraged the first century readers. This is a redeemed mankind on a new earth, without the hindrance of being people estranged from God on a world broken by rebellion. They can now fulfill the creation mandate given originally to subdue, fill, and care for the earth. But this will be neither a return to the beginning nor a starting over again from scratch. I believe that splendor, glory, and honor indicate that all that is best from this present earth will be brought into the city. The best of what had been done in fulfillment of that creation task will be there. Even though everything was tainted and distorted by sin, it will be purified and brought to God's purified people to perfect and to expand. All that is best in culture, in art, music, drama, and literature will be there. All that is valid in science, all that is useful in engineering, all that is true in historical study will be there. Every story of kindness, every story of a life lived with love and faith, no matter how obscure, will be gathered like treasure. Even though the greatness of much literature and art is derived from sinful themes, as is historical writing too, purified people will be able to see and hear and read without being tempted to sin. They will be able to perceive it as showing the goodness and kindness of God's amazing grace to redeem people from such a rebellious, broken world. The beauty which we can see and hear and create now are only a shadow of what will be seen and heard and created in the new earth. We will go on with the task. That which is best from every culture, from every tribe, in every language, from every people and every nation will be there. Study and learning, if true, reveal the reality which God already knows. So study helps us see the world the way that God already does, as it truly is. While this is so to some extent now, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. And you have my final conclusion there in your notes. All will participate in this, in the new earth. But even now, as I think of the investigation that goes on in Oxbridge of the worlds of nature and of society, I think this is part of what God made humankind to do. It is not perfect, but neither is it all destined to become nothing. God will preserve it and perfect it along with the New Jerusalem. I long that many in Oxbridge and everywhere might come to realize this, to praise God, and so rejoice before Him in their work, whatever their work is. Even so, let us take heart and do our work with the confidence that it is worthwhile both in the present and for eternity. And those are my thoughts on the New Jerusalem. How do you organize discussion?
We organize discussion by saying if anyone would like to ask questions, add things, subtract, whatever, Joe's willing to stay on and we can have a discussion. If you need to go, feel free to just take off because we'll go for probably a while. And we want people to be free to leave if they need to leave. So, over to you all. lot to deal with.
Yeah. I wonder if light and other physical properties are significantly different, so that what we've learned in science here about materials and such things will no longer be applicable, or maybe a simple echo of it or something?
That's an interesting question. If they're the same, I'm sure that there will be a lot analogous that will be worthwhile, and if they're different, and if they're the same, it can continue. But I believe that it will continue with scientific exploration and all sorts of things. The church was not well served by Victorian pictures of angels strumming harps on clouds. That's not our future. That's not our future.
That just struck me because you were saying I'm sure what Joe said is right, but on the other hand, you look at the history of science and the number of paradigm shifts within science in our brief history, it's hard to imagine there won't be further paradigm shifts to go in terms of scientific models. I suspect to be totally surprised. I expect everyone is going to be totally surprised in all sorts of areas. While there's continuity at the same time.
Yeah. So I don't know which way, but it's going to be exciting to find out.
What do you think will be our jobs? I mean, we can't really know that, but in creation.
Well, our purpose will continue to be to love God with all our heart and mind and soul and strength, and to love people. Mm-hmm. And I imagine we'll be able to pick a job. It may well be something that we thought in this world, I would love to have done that. And circumstances have conspired to mean that we've never had the chance to. And we may be able to. It may well be something that we love, and I'd like to keep on going in this. That, to me, it's an exciting vision, far from boring.
I'm just struck by the need for more teaching on the New Jerusalem for all kinds of reasons. But one of the reasons that struck me as you were talking, the motivation that it provides for living the Christian life now and for actually trying to make the world into a place that pleases God now, as opposed to a theology of hell, which is motivated essentially by fear and produces... I'm not questioning a theology of hell. I'm just saying that if that's our motivation for living the Christian life, is essentially fear rather than the attempts that we make to please God now will continue forever. We'll be purified one day. And that is the positive motivation for living the Christian life. To me, I think I just think that the church would be very different today if more people believed that, or if there was more teaching on the New Jerusalem. I don't know if you have any reflections on that, but the positive motivation that you're mentioning here is really exciting to me.
Yeah, it's exciting to me too, Ben. And as I think about that, there was a time when, with then culture, people believed in the reality of hell, and therefore speaking to it said something to them. But for us to continue to base our evangelism on that means that, in effect, we have to convince people first to believe in hell before we can convince them that we have something important to say about not going to hell, not being condemned. Whereas the God who is there and Jesus Christ who became flesh in this world is, to me, so attractive and so important to know now. And this vision of what life will be in the future if we return to Him and know Him, that that's an attraction that we should use in our evangelism. And just let people know that